So here we are. In part three, I talked about how the great mess up resulted in a rift between humans and God. And as a result of that, a rift among people themselves and also between humanity and the rest of creation. God's perfect peace is gone. And humanity's God-given task to fill the earth and create culture is way down and distorted by evil. After the great mess up, life goes on, but it goes on without God at the center. Culture advances, but the good is mixed with the bad. And if we're real, it's pretty obvious that history reflects this. If we think about our own personal stories, the same is true. I think most of us would agree that despite the tough stuff, there's still a lot of good things in life. Life's a mix of good and bad. You see, just because we turned our backs to God doesn't mean He turned His back on us. Just the opposite. Because we're made in His image, we can love and be loved by others. We can enjoy the company of other people. We can have families and we can create all sorts of things and share and enjoy the things we invent and make. The planet continues to produce food and water for us, even if famine and drought are a reality. Natural disasters do happen, but nature can be breathtaking. We continue to enjoy rain on a hot summer day, the colors of autumn, and the occasional snowstorm and all the fun stuff that brings. It's God who keeps all the complexity of the universe going so that humans can continue through the generations and can live and create all kinds of things that might make life easier and better. It's just that things that aren't good, things that are evil, are part of the mix. The world is broken and we live in a broken world. So, it's clear that God continues to love His creation even after the great mess up. But the truth is, insofar as we don't know God and are not in relationship with Him, we can't know that we're His beloved. And if we're not aware of being God's beloved, we don't know who we really are. And we'll always look to fill that hole in our hearts with something. And even if that something is good in itself, it can't match the unending, limitless goodness of God. Eventually, it will either disappoint us, leave, or run out. Let's just be honest about this. Anything outside of God is just part of broken creation. It's broken, so it can't ultimately fix anything. Thankfully, God wants something better for us. He wants us to know we're His beloved. But there's a problem. Genesis tells us that after the great mess up, the human heart is turned to evil all the time. Now, wait a minute. What's with that? It seems a bit over the top, doesn't it? I mean, all of us can think of at least one person with a quote-unquote good heart. You know, that person who's always kind and generous, always looking out for their neighbor. The fact that we can realistically identify people like that is proof that we have some knowledge of what good is. Remember, we're made in God's image, and we have a conscience. But the fact is that we also now have knowledge of evil. It's part of the world we live in. Think of it this way. Before the great mess up, the image of God in humanity was like a crystal clear glass mirror, reflecting the image clearly. After the great mess up, the image is like what we would see if we held up a strip of metal to our face. The reflection is hazy and distorted. The distorted image comes from the fact that all of us, no matter how good we are by the standards of a broken world, fall short of God's perfect goodness. And if we're perfectly honest, all of us have done things we're ashamed of. You know, those things we regret doing. Things like when we want something so badly that we go for it, even when we know that doing that will either hurt us or someone else. It's the seductive invitation in the garden, all over again. We take the fruit and bite. By the same token, most of us have been hurt by bad choices other people have made, and our hearts are weighed down by those hurts. In either case, after the great mess up, the human heart is sick, full of bad personal choices, and weighed down by things done to us by other broken people. Remember, evil is everything not God, not good. And that includes more than the bad stuff we've done. It includes pain, sorrow, and the inevitability of death. All those things that God never intended for us, but are now part of the broken world we live in. A heart like this needs healing. A heart like this needs a fresh start. A heart like this needs to know it is loved by God and that it doesn't need to look to some created thing for escape from pain, shame, or emptiness. A heart like this needs a God-sized rescue plan. So here we are, the God-sized rescue plan. The first part of this plan is laid out in the part of the Bible called the Old Testament, which basically records all the history that comes before Jesus, all the stuff that occurs before the first century AD. The Old Testament takes up a long section of the Bible, starting with Genesis, going straight through 37 books, ending with the 39th book called Malachi. These 39 books record the weaving together of the human story and God's story as it unfolds in the history of ancient Israel, beginning with an ancient Near Eastern man named Abraham. After the great mess up, after the divorce, God sets about reestablishing trust with humanity by inviting Abraham back into relationship with himself, with the intent of extending this invitation to everyone. So, God makes himself known to Abraham, whose family grows into a tribe of people who eventually become the ancient nation called Israel. By joining Abraham's, then Israel's story to his own, God literally shows the world who he is by stepping into human history to invite all of us back into his story. Okay, before we go on, the burning questions. Why Abraham? Why Israel? Why that time and place in history? Before tackling those questions, I'd like us to think about this. If the story in the Old Testament was made up by a person, we would expect that there would be either some explanation or reason given for choosing ancient Abraham slash Israel, or short of this, Abraham slash Israel would be a superhero slash a nation of superheroes who would slay all the evil forces plaguing humanity and usher in utopia where everyone would live happily ever after with happy, healthy hearts. Or God would suddenly appear and zap some God sense into wayward, rebellious humanity, who would then turn to him, and everyone would live happily ever after with happy, healthy hearts. But the story in the Old Testament isn't a human story. It's God's story. That's why it's so strange, so unsettling. If you don't believe me, read it for yourself. Anyway, there's no explanation for why Abraham and not James or John or Mary, and no explanation of why Israel and not Persia or Egypt or India. Also, there's no divine zapping and no superheroes with amazing powers. Rather, there's God in all of his godness. The story is strange because it's not primarily about us. It's about an awesome, like nothing we've ever seen God, reaching out to real people with sick hearts by literally stepping into the messy nitty-gritty of their history. All we know from the Bible is that God chose Israel because he loved them. I thought God loves all of his creation. He does. And here's the really important part. The record in the Bible goes on to explain that God didn't choose Israel because its people were extra good, or extra religious, or extra anything. In fact, God calls them stiff-necked and rebellious. Well, that pretty much describes all of humanity after the great mess up. So, putting this together, we can think of Israel as a particular sampling of humanity in general. God loves them like he loves all of his creation, and he chooses them simply because he chooses them. The fact of the matter is that in order to enter history, God had to enter at some particular place and time and reveal himself to actual, real people. We get that. That's history. It's real because it deals with real people and real events. God could have begun his rescue plan with anyone, but he picked Israel for his own reasons, and we leave it at that. He's God. The really important thing is that he literally shows Israel who he is: loving, good, compassionate, merciful, just, and God alone, the unequaled, mighty someone they could trust, a someone worth having a relationship with. He doesn't send them a book describing his sparkling personality. Nope. He enters into a relationship with them. And through this real, historically nitty-gritty relationship with Israel, God shows himself not only to that particular group of people, but also to the other nations around them. That's the whole point: to spread the knowledge of who he is to folks who don't know him yet. So God chooses one man, then one nation, in order to invite all people and all nations back into relationship with himself. Invite all people. Emphasis on all. That gets us to the last question. Why start way back in ancient times? Couldn't God have compressed the whole rescue plan and saved a bunch of time and energy? Well, that's thinking like us again. I'm going to take a stab at this. Follow me here for a minute. We know God created everything, right? That means he created time, which means he's above or outside of time. For him, everything exists in a present moment that never ends. In that moment, he sees the past, the present, and the future. That's mind-blowing. But remember, he's God. So, if we look at this from our time-bound perspective, in God's present moment are all the people he created in the past, those in the present, and all the people he will create in the future. This means that the rescue plan goes on for thousands of centuries because God wants a maximum number of people to know him and to know that they're his beloved. Think of it as an open invitation to an awesome party that remains open for a super long time because the guest list is crazy long. Okay, a lot of time passes and there's a lot of stuff that happens in the Old Testament that we can't get into right now. But we can trace the three themes we've been following from the creation story to see how this part of God's story all ties together. Here we go. In a nutshell, God makes a treaty or covenant with Abraham, where God promises to give him many descendants, land, and most importantly, himself, his presence. Note the parallels with the creation story. Humanity's job to fill the earth is echoed in God's promise to Abraham of many descendants. God promises to be with Abraham. This parallels access to the amazing garden we saw in the creation story, where God is in perfect relationship with the first humans. Along this line, about the land God promises to give Abraham. Well, it's ancient Palestine, and it's described in the Old Testament as a land flowing with milk and honey. In other words, it's an extremely fertile place that can support abundant life. Again, note the parallel with the garden full of lush, edible vegetation in the creation story. God tells Abraham that his descendants will inherit that land with a promise that Abraham will be a blessing to all nations. Remember the God-given task to create culture in the creation story? With Abraham, we're back to the Genesis story where the original tasks of filling the earth and creating culture are carried out with God at the center of it all. In the Abraham story, the relationship between God and humanity is reestablished with the treaty or covenant that God makes. And the garden is now ancient Palestine, from which God-centered culture-creating power is to extend from there and flow out to all the earth. Also, Abraham knows God, and God is with him. So we see here the first and third themes we looked at appearing in actual real human history through Abraham's history. Before moving on to the second theme, trust and obey, a couple of words about land. It's a big deal in the Old Testament, and it's a big deal for all of us. How so? Humanity's deep tie with the earth is made clear in the creation story. Remember, the first humans are made from the dust of the earth, and their job to create culture is tied to working the land. Think about this. Agriculture is the foundation of civilization. No food, no civilization, no culture. Pretty simple and still true today. After the great mess up, not only does farming happen in a broken world, but also humans are alienated from the planet that sustains them. This means that exploitation of the planet will continue as long as humanity remains alienated from the God who made both them and the earth that sustains us. The earth is part of the rescue plan. More on this later. But back to the themes. Okay, the second theme. The treaty God makes with Abraham holds as long as Abraham trusts God and operates within the boundaries God gives him. Sound familiar? Remember the forbidden fruit and the opportunity to ignore this boundary in the creation story? Trust is not trust unless there's an opportunity not to trust. Same for Abraham. If you read through all the Abraham stories, you see how flawed and limited both he and his wife Sarah are. They're humans with sick hearts living in a broken world. Nevertheless, despite their mistakes and fumbles, they continue to trust God through all the trials of life, never losing hope in the promises God gave them, including that huge promise that they would play a major role in God's rescue plan. Every time they make a mistake, they admit it, change their ways, God forgives them, and they move on. They learn that God is not only perfectly good and perfectly God, there is no other. He stands alone. That's crystal clear in the Old Testament. They also learn that he's compassionate and forgiving. His love is boundless. The story of their walk with God becomes an example of how to walk with God in a world that's a mix of good and bad, a world that presents numerous opportunities to not trust God. All right. Fast forward, Abraham and Sarah's son Isaac grows into a tribe of people and then into the nation of Israel. And we see a similar plot line unfold. God makes a treaty or a covenant with Israel, where God promises to give them many descendants, land, and his presence with them. The treaty holds as long as Israel trusts God and operates within the boundaries he gives them. The difference is that they actually get the land promised to Abraham, and God dwells with them in the temple in Jerusalem. Like with Abraham and Sarah, the three themes, know God, trust and obey God, be in relationship with God, become concrete and real in Israel's history, and not just ideas. It's something everyone with eyes can see. Israel's supposed to show everyone else who God is. The point was for them to show their neighbors that peace could be found in a relationship with this God. Now, as long as God was at the center of Israel's life, their social, political, economic, and religious structures stood out as being more just, less oppressive, and just better than those around them. But remember, Israel lives in a broken world where there is the constant temptation to go it alone rather than to walk with God. When you read through all 39 of the books of the Old Testament, you start to see how flawed and limited the Israelites are. Like Abraham and Sarah, life is full of rubber-hitting-the-road moments as they are challenged to trust God. Some folks hang on and trust God when the going gets rough. They seek God and live within His boundaries. And when they make a mistake, they turn to Him, admit their mistakes, and change their ways. Many, however, including many of Israel's religious and political leaders, choose the forbidden fruit. They choose the desires of their own hearts, including the desire to be like the powerful nations around them. They reject God's boundaries, thinking they might get something better and become just like the nations around them. So instead of showing their neighbors who God is by showing them what living in relationship with God looks like, Israel ends up looking exactly like its broken neighbors. Self-interest and a lust for power consumes them, and they spiral into greed, violence, murder, and exploitation. Israel's political, social, and economic structures decay and crumble. Their land is polluted with depravity and bloodshed, and it vomits them out. Israel is carried into exile by the conquering Assyrians and Babylonians. And here's where the story hits a serious roadblock. Throughout its checkered history, God sends prophets to Israel to remind its leaders of their covenant with God. Remember, prophets are folks who hear from God about things humans wouldn't know about otherwise, things like what God thinks and what His plans are. They are sent by God to call Israel back. Over and over and over again, God holds out His hands to Israel through His prophets. Over and over and over again, the nation as a whole insists on a divorce. And just like in the creation story, God gives it to them. Off they go into exile. They lose the land and the temple. They lose God. There you go, Israel's long and messy history in a couple of paragraphs. So what's all this got to do with us living in the Western Hemisphere thousands of years later? First, God and grace, the two G's, go together. Think of grace as a totally undeserved gift that God freely gives to us for no other reason than that He loves us. It's undeserved because, remember, we're the party that asked for a divorce and walked away. Recall I said that God chose Abraham than Israel for no reason apparent to us? Neither was extra special or extra religious. Abraham worshiped idols just like everyone else at the time, before God stepped into his life. It was all grace on God's part. Abraham and Israel were as stiff-necked and rebellious as the next guy. God reaching out to any of us is all grace on His part. He doesn't limit it to extra special or extra religious people. Just like He didn't need to create us in the first place, God could have just left us alone to completely destroy ourselves and the planet, and we would have done a great job. But as we read through Israel's history, we learn that God is unparalleled. This awesome and mighty God doesn't think twice about stooping down to our level to make an offer completely for our benefit. He doesn't need us, and he doesn't need to do this. But he graciously offers to come back into relationship with rebellious people in order to heal, save, restore, and guide them back to peace and wholeness. The very same offer holds true today. God is all about grace. Also, the boundaries that God lays down are all about grace. God gave Israel a thing called the law, which can be summarized in two simple sentences. Love God with all your heart, soul, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. The law gave Israel boundaries for how they were to structure their social, political, economic, and religious life. This set limits for how Israel was to use its culture-creating power. So, when God graciously gives the law to them, the point isn't to saddle them with all kinds of nitpicky rules and regulations. Just because the religious authorities later went crazy with empty and meaningless rule-keeping, more on that later, doesn't mean God intended that. God's point with the law was to show Israel a different way to live, a gracious alternative to the world's way of power-grabbing, domination, injustice, and oppression. Without the law, there would have been no alternative to broken ways of creating culture, since brokenness was all humanity knew. The law not only set out an alternative way of life, but also provided a way to admit failures and to get right with God again. Again, all grace from a merciful, gracious God. In the same way, the temple in Jerusalem where Israel was supposed to worship God was all about grace. The temple was there to show the world that the one-of-a-kind God who lives in heaven also longs to live among his people. Couple of words about this. In the Old Testament, heaven doesn't refer to the sky or earth's atmosphere. It refers to the spiritual kingdom where God reigns, surrounded by his heavenly court, made up of the angels and his angelic armies. Remember I said that trying to describe the realities of God is like trying to shove Mount Everest into a Coca-Cola can? Well, this is another example of this. The Old Testament prophets use the imagery of a king surrounded by his court and his military muscle to describe God's digs because that's what resonated with ancient people who were surrounded on all sides by powerful human kings. The descriptions of God's heavenly throne room are mind-blowing and not like anything ever seen on earth. Read them for yourself. The point is, it's all grace when God chooses to step down from his glorious throne room and dwell in a temple built by humans. Think of it this way. He's king of all the earth. So, he lives in a mansion bigger and grander than anything we can imagine. But God chooses to move into a tiny bungalow in a neighborhood full of scruffy, unruly people who most of the time don't really want him there, at least not on his terms, just so he can be with them. Second, besides showing us that God is all about grace, the Old Testament shows us that God's perfect goodness makes it impossible for him to just accept evil, shrug his shoulders, and just say, whatever. At a gut level, we know that this would be neither good nor just on God's part. We're made in his image, so we're wired for justice. This gets us to the important lesson about evil that the Old Testament teaches. Up to now, God has revealed to Israel who he is and all the benefits of being in relationship with him. Yet, despite all these real-life lessons, evil continues to distort and corrupt Israel's culture, its political, social, and religious structures. What becomes clear in the Old Testament is that evil is bigger than just bad personal choices. It certainly includes these things, but it's bigger and badder than them. Evil is a spiritual force bent not only on getting people to rebel against God, but also a force that just seeps into every part of creation. It's a power that can only be defeated by a greater power, and that power doesn't come from us. Why do I say this? It's clear from the history recorded in the Old Testament that there will always be folks who will listen, change course, and return to God while the majority of the world continues to march to its own drumbeat. What gives with that? Everything that is part of human culture is tainted and distorted by evil, simply because it's part of a broken world. Now, this doesn't mean that all human traditions, institutions, and social, economic, and political structures are completely bad and totally bad. It's clear some are better than others. Most are a mix of good and bad. But it does mean that no nation, no human authority, no institution, philosophy, ideology, scientific or technological advancement, and no utopian plan is perfect and can fix the problem of evil. All utopian plans are the product of broken human beings operating in a broken world. They will all ultimately disappoint. Any serious student of history will tell you this. There's always the temptation for any one of these broken things, these institutions, these structures, to become absolute and to exalt itself as a solution to all of humanity's problems. When any part of human culture assumes this role, it joins with the spiritual forces that are in rebellion against God. Clearly, what's needed is a solution that's not part of broken creation. The Jews who come back from home after the exile learn this lesson the hard way. They begin to look for a God-sized solution because they realize they need one. How so? Well, the prophets had told them that God would forgive them and bring them back home after the exile. And they do go home, humbled and contrite, ready to acknowledge God as God and ready to trust Him and His boundaries. They even rebuild the temple. But before long, the powers of the world crush them again. First Alexander the Great, and eventually Rome. In 63 BC, Israel is sucked into the Roman Empire, and domination and repressive regimes are the name of the game again. So, what do the Israelites do living under Roman rule? They start to look for someone bigger than the Roman emperor. They look to God, and they begin to wait for His Messiah, someone who will not only save them from the Romans, but who will also heal their sick, rebellious hearts once and for all. A someone who will give them back their land and who will make them the people from which God's rule will extend out into the rest of the world. They base their hope for a God-sized Messiah on the fact that the prophets not only told them that God would bring them back home after the exile, but also that God would do even greater and more wonderful things. Things like restoring perfect peace to all of creation. No more war, violence, or domination. No more sorrow. No more tears. No more death. No more striving to eke out food from the land. No more famine or drought. God would again be at the center of created life and would live among His people, people from all nations who would turn from their rebellious ways. Sound familiar? It's pretty much the picture we get in the creation story before the great mess up, but better. Better because in this new creation, evil is defeated once for all. No more talking snakes. So, onto the stage of human history enters Jesus, man and God, God in flesh and bone, bigger and badder than the Roman emperor, the answer to humanity's alienation from God and its weakness in the face of evil. Now, Israel, looking at these promises given by the prophets, couldn't totally wrap its mind around what it all meant. All kinds of ideas emerged about what this promised Messiah would look like, what exactly he would do, and how he would do it. None of the Messiah proposals on offer quite got it. When Jesus came, he blew all of them out of the water, as we will see in the next part of God's story. Jesus is God, so why are we surprised? But as usual, we are. The way God defeats evil and death through Jesus defied all of Israel's ideas and expectations about power. I invite you to go to the next part of God's story, part 5, and check it out. It's God. It's wild. It's the best part of the story. Jesus is the final chapter of history, and he invites each of us to get to know him, to walk through life with him, as his story, God's story, unfolds in and through each one of our own unique stories. There's a place for you in God's story. The invitation is open. Jesus is holding out his hands to you. All you have to do is tell him you're sorry for rebelling and turning your back to him and say, "Yes, Jesus, I want to be part of your story. I'm tired of all the broken stories that I've heard and that I'm listening to. Jesus, I want you to set right the messes I've made, and I want a fresh start. Please heal my heart. I want to be part of the new creation you are bringing to reality." If you would like to hang out with other folks looking to get to know Jesus better, folks wanting to experience God in everyday life, folks who want to hear more about God's story and be part of it, come and see what River of Grace is about. If you want to learn more about God's story, check out GodStoryYourIdentity.org for Part 5, Jesus, the God-Sized Rescuer.